Now we're holding on page Hey Hey in Bhavabhasra, Ois Ayin Tes. We started learning before about the problem of being Otzer Peiros, about people hoarding produce where they buy up and they corner the market, and then later on they take advantage of poor people by selling it when there's less supply and prices are going to be higher. Then they sell it at those higher prices. And the Gemara had severely criticized such people and saying that Hashem is going to punish them. And the Gemara deals with certain dinim about that. There's certain dinim of when you're allowed to buy up produce and then store it and when not, and various details about that. So the Gemara says, Avur de Shmuel, Mazbin Lahula Peri B'tarich Harifa. Now Avur de Shmuel, the father of Shmuel, would buy produce when the prices were cheaper. Now you have like this. The way it worked then was, even now, of course, you have a harvest season, and then you have and then later on you have various other parts of the season. But nowadays, with the global supply chains and all that, you have much less variation during the year. But back then, the idea was right after the harvest, you would have prices are fairly low. Everybody's harvested their grain, and now there's a large supply, and therefore prices are low. Eventually, you have, as we know, for example, Sukkot is called Chag HaOsif. You would have a point when everybody leaves it out drying in the fields all summer. Eventually comes Tishrei, Elul Tishrei time, they gather it into their barns and they store it there. After that, prices start going up because now there's less supply available. An individual farmer wants to sell, then he's going to be selling, but basically people are keeping it for themselves over the winter. So the original price right after the harvest is called Tara Harifa, which literally means the sharp price, which means, in other words, the price that you have Now you have later on, the Harifa also means early. So at the early price. So Avur de Shmuel would sell his produce, Mazbin Lahu, he would sell the peri, his produce, the Tara Harifa, at the cheap price, Kitara Harifa, according to the low cheap price. So in other words, as soon as the harvest is done, he would go and sell his produce at that point at the cheaper prices. Shmuel Brei, on the other hand, his son Shmuel, Mashi Lepeli, he would hold on to his produce for a while, or Mazvin Lahuba, Tara Afla, Katara Harifa. He would do later on, when it's Tara Afla, when it's the later prices, later in the agricultural year, when prices are likely to be higher, then at that point is when he would, at that point he would take out his produce and sell it, Batara Afla, during the time of the late prices, Kitara Harifa, following the earlier, cheaper prices of the year. So in other words, both of them are selling at the same cheap price, but the difference is Avur de Shmuel is doing it during the time of the harvest, Shmuel is doing it later on after everybody has gathered theirs into the storehouses. Rashbam points out it wasn't that he wouldn't be buying produce to be able to store and sell after everything's in the barns, because the fact is that does contribute to shortages. Fine, it wouldn't be. He's not cornering the market or anything, but it still contributes a little bit to shortages and causes a little bit to a rise in price. So then you have to sort of the hefseger. Rashbam points out one would cancel out the other. So no, we're talking about his own produce, that instead of selling it right away, he would sell it later on in the year, but he would sell it for the cheaper price. Shtocho mitam, they sent a message from there, from Eretz Yisrael, tova de abba midibra. What the father, Avur de Shmuel, is doing is better than what the son is doing. My time, my wife, Tara, kiven de rovach rovach. When prices are cheaper, they tend to stay cheaper. So Avur de Shmuel, who's selling it right away at the cheap price, and thereby there's more supply available and people are able to buy it at a cheaper price, that's better because that tends to keep, now that the price has been established that it's going to be cheap, it'll tend to stay cheaper later on. It will go up later in the agricultural year because there's less supply, but it still won't go up as much. As opposed to Avur de Shmuel is already once, as opposed to Shmuel's way of doing it, the prices have already gone up. Now to get them to go down is a lot harder. So it was better. It was better the way that Avur de Shmuel did it. So why did Shmuel do it the way he did? Yon Yaakov points out because he figured it's kind of complementary. Once his father is arranging that the prices should be cheaper at the beginning of the season, then small figures than he should do at the other end of the season. He should be working on at the other end of the season to make sure that it's cheap then also. Nevertheless, they're saying that your father still did better. The Gemara continues, Tanrabanan, Ein Metzien, more on the topic of avoiding shortages in Eretz Yisrael, Ein Metzien Peres from Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to export produce from Eretz Yisrael, specifically Dvarim Sheyesh Ben Chayin Nefesh, things that are necessary for basic human survival, not basic maybe, but whatever, for the standard things that people eat. For example, wine, oil, and flour. Those are things. They need a steady supply of them in Eretz Yisrael. If you export them to other countries, then it's going to cause shortages in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseda Mata Begayin, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseda says, you are allowed to export wine from Eretz Yisrael, because that reduces the amount of silliness and drunkenness. Tifla means like Alos Rosh, that sort of thing, lightheadedness, a lack of seriousness, nichmas yayin yotzasoid, as Rashbam points out, the famous expression in the Gemara. So the less wine is being drunk, the less there's going to be that kind of thing of people blabbing their secrets and things like that. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseda says it's fine to export that. Marsha has an interesting explanation over here of this. This sheds a new light on what went on with the Meraglin. When they come back with their giant cluster of fruit, with their giant cluster of grapes and their fig and their pomegranate, and they're saying that fine, it's zavas cholav advashi v'zepiria. That itself was actually part of their lashon hara. They're saying very nice. Eretz Yisrael has lots of grapes. But that causes more tifla, and so it has fruits that you could eat, such as pomegranates and figs. But actual things like wheat and barley that you need for a staple, wheat and barley and olives that you need as staples, and that everybody agrees you shouldn't be exporting from Eretz Yisrael, they claim that Eretz Yisrael doesn't have, which was false. Eretz Yisrael has all shrivas and minim. And so they go on to say, in other words, what happens? So they're arguing, in other words, what's going to happen? Eretz Echeles Yeshveh Ha'hi, Eretz Yisrael is very prone to famines because it doesn't have a steady supply of Dvarim Sheyesh Bahem Chayei Nefesh. You see, they said the Avos had to go down to Mitzrayim because of famines. Meanwhile, they're ignoring the fact that by each of the Avos, where with Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, there was each a specific reason why there was a famine in their time. It's not that Eretz Yisrael is particularly prone to them. In any case, that all fits very nicely, Marashal says, with this Gemara over here, that flour and oil are staples, and the Meraglim pretended as though Eretz Yisrael doesn't have those, and wine, fine, the Tanakhama is saying don't export that either, because it's necessary, but even Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseda is, you know what, it's not really such a good thing for there to be a steady supply of wine. So in this connection, speaking of potential shortages in Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara says, "Tanan Rabbanan, ein yotzin me'aretz l'chutz la'aretz." You're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael to move to Chutz La'aretz. Elim kein umdu sa sayim besela, unless prices have risen so much that 2 sa of wheat cost a sela. The normal price would be 4 sa to a sela. So here, prices are twice as expensive. So then you're allowed to leave. Amar Rav Shimon, aim aside, but Rav Shimon says, when would that apply? Bizman she'enim motzil likach. When you can't find those shortages of produce and you can't find what to buy, then you're entitled to leave Eretz Yisrael. Bizman she'motzil likach. But Rav Shimon argues, when there is supply available, just prices are high, I feel that omdu sa b'sela, even if a sa costs a sela, so it's 4 times as much. Lo yetzeh say, nevertheless, a person should not leave Eretz Yisrael. So Tosfos wonders, by the way, it's not printed here in Ein Yaakov, but Tosfos wonders, wait a minute. So what Rav Shimon is saying, that if you can't find to buy, then you're allowed to leave. So what does the Tanakhama hold? If you can't find what to buy, then you're not allowed to leave. What are you supposed to live off of? So Tosfos leaves the question open. Various Mephoshim give different answers. One of them being that the Tanakhama is saying, yeah, if you can't find what to buy, of course you can leave. But Rav Shimon is saying, the Tanakhama is saying, if there's no supply at all, of course you can leave. You're not expected to starve. But even if there is supply, once the prices are twice as much as normal, then you're allowed to leave. Whereas Rav Shimon would be saying that, no, you're not allowed to. Even then, as long as there is supply, then you don't have the right to leave Eretz Yisrael. That's one explanation. The first one, the Rambam, give that, the Rinnigash, not the Rinnigash, the Yad Ramah, gives a similar explanation. Another explanation, Eitz Yosef brings over here from Toras Chaim, is that what it means is you might have a case where you can't, there's no wheat available for purchase to make your own bread, but there's bread available. Now, the Gemara tells us in Menachos that it's not such a good thing to rely on a baker. The Gemara has an expression over there when the pasuk says "Vahayu chayecha tluim l'chami negev," that it says at the end of the Torah in Kisavo, your life is going to be hanging in the balance. Refers to a person who has to rely on a commercial baker, because what if the guy goes out of business? Then you don't have a supply of bread. So the case would be over here that you are able to find bread to eat, but you are able to find bread to buy, but that's not really the business. So therefore, so the Tanakhama would say you're allowed to leave, and Reb Shimon would say even that not, unless their parsha isn't food available. Reb Shimon Yochai said in a similar vein. Now, we just had Reb Shimon. Here we have Reb Shimon Yochai. It's the same person. So there's an interesting explanation that maybe we refer to him specifically as Reb Shimon Ben Yochai when he was younger and he said it, and then he wasn't so well known yet. So later on, he became known as just plain Reb Shimon, so then they dropped the Ben Yochai. With that said, though, there are various gersois over here that the v'chein hoya, that there's actually different other Reb Shimons. We have a number of different tanoim who bear the first name Reb Shimon, so there's different gersois over here that the v'chein hoya Reb Shimon ben one of the other patronymics rather than Ben Yochai. Anyway, he said, Eli Melech, let's look at the story of Rus. Megillas Rus begins by Hidmei Shvot HaShoftim, in the time of the Shoftim, by Hidrov Ba'orat, there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael, and the pasuk says that a man from Beis Lechem left with his family and moved to Moab, Elimelech and his wife Naomi and their two sons Machlon and Kilion. And the whole story starts with that. So Reb Shimon says, Elimelech, Machlon, Kilion, Gedolei HaDor HaYu. They were great people of the generation. They were tzaddikim. Uparnosei HaDor HaYu. And they were the leaders of the generation. So why were they punished? Rather than the pasuk says, after they moved to Moab, first Elimelech died, then Machlon and Kilion died. So what happened? It's because they left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz. In other words, even though the pasuk is saying there was a famine, nevertheless they shouldn't have left. So you see, says Reb Shimon, that even when there's a famine, it's still not right to leave Eretz Yisrael. Incidentally, in that connection, also about the prices, about that it's usually four saw to a seller, and here Reb Shimon is talking about a case where prices are four times as much. Interesting thing, you have in Melachim, you have the story, there was at one point there was a siege of Shomron, plus there was a famine going on, and it was terrible. People are buying garbage at high prices, people are even killing their own children, like you have in the Teuchach, I don't know if they were killing them or just whatever, eating them and they were dead, whatever. Anyway, then you have the whole story, which is the Haftorah, Parshas Mitzorda, with Vavar Noshim Hoyim Mitzorayim, how they went and found the camp of Aram empty, and everybody went and plundered it. Elisha says over there in Nevuah, and the pasuk describes how it came exactly true, that he says a saw of wheat flour, or two saw of barley flour, will be selling for a shekel, which is the same as the sela of the Gemara over here, tomorrow at the gate of Shomron. So the Malbim actually points out in the pasuk, you know, the fact is, even that is still far higher than it should be, as we see in our Gemara, that's four times the regular price. Nevertheless, though, it'll still be better than it was before, where they're reduced to eating garbage and whatever. Okay. So they left out.
Because they were Rosh Hashanah and people are looking after them, if they are leaving, everybody will.
So one second, we'll talk about that in a second, so wait. But first, the Gemara is saying not even that. Just the fact, as Shimon Ben Yochai is saying, just the fact that they left Eretz Yisrael for Chutz La'aretz is reason enough for them to be punished. As the pasuk says, "Vakehun kol ha'ir aleihem," the entire city was in an uproar about them. When the pasuk describes when Naomi and Rus made it back to Beis Lechem, the pasuk says the whole city was in an uproar. What's going on over here? Vakemarna, and they said, "Hazois Naomi, is this Naomi?" So my Hazois Naomi, what does this mean? Is this Naomi? And the fact is, they're saying Hazois Naomi, but they're not saying anything about her. Or what are they so surprised about? Omer Rav Yitzchak, Omru, Chazisem Naomi, have you seen what happened to Naomi? She yotzema oretz v'chutz la'aretz. She left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz. Ma osala, what happened to her? So in other words, you see, says Reb Shimon, and says Rav Yitzchak, that just the leaving of Eretz Yisrael alone is a serious thing and then cause them to get punished. Now, first of all, Maharsha says that the word shenemar doesn't really belong over here. It's not really a proof. It's really a separate statement. So first we're saying, Reb Shimon is saying that they were punished because they left Chutz Lartz. Then you have a separate thing that everybody's saying, Hazois Nomi, did you see what happened with Nomi? How do we get that? Maharsha explains, by the way, the word Hazois, we're darshaning the hey as a ches. So not Hazois, but Chazois. Meloshen Choza. Do you see what happened with Nomi? So now Maharsha brings in this connection actually from Rashi brings on over there on Rus from the Medrash. What happened was that also they were stingy. Einam Sarda, they were stingy and they didn't want to give. They figured, Elimelech figured, all the poor people, now when there's a famine, all the poor people are gonna come to me asking for tzedakah, and I don't want to have to give them. So therefore they left. So yeah, like you're saying, that was a very discouraging thing to everybody, that they're stuck without somebody to help them. Mefoshim point out that first of all, Maharsha says the point is, in other words, that if they had stayed in Eretz Yisrael, they might not have died. But in fact, Mefoshim point out that part of the meaning of when it says Vatehem Kol Ha'ir Aleihem, the entire city was in an uproar about them, wondering what happened. Meaning, in other words, Mefoshim explained based on a medrash, it means that even though there had been a terrible famine, nobody actually died from it. So it was very ironic. They're saying, look at that. We stayed over here and toughed it out through the famine and the Avish that helped us. Nobody died. You guys left to Eretz Yisrael for the relative safety of Moab, and three out of the four of you are dead. So all of that. So in other words, we see that their leaving Eretz Yisrael was a very serious thing and they were punished for it. Ion Yaakov points out, if they weren't the Gdol HaDor, you might have said they were punished for the Averis of the generation, but they were also Parnosei HaDor, and that means, in other words, that if they had been good Parnosim, then they would have protected the generation with their Schusim, and here we're saying that Fakir, not only they didn't protect them, but they themselves died, the reason is because they left Eretz Yisrael. There's a point that's made in this connection. The Maharal mentions something along this line. It's Chiddush HaGadus and other Mefoshim talk about the idea that the Gemara is going to talk about later. There's Chus Avos, that there's Chus Avos didn't protect them. So the idea is because there's Chus Avos, and then really the Chus of us Jewish people collectively is tied in with Eretz Yisrael. So then a person separates himself from that, and I can't be bothered. I don't want to stay there. It's too difficult over there. Then he kind of forfeits that protection and that bris. The Medrash, in fact, has an expression. The Medrash compares Eretz Yisrael to a maidservant who raised the king's three sons. The three sons are from Yitzchak Yaakov. So we see if a person abandons Eretz Yisrael and doesn't consider it important for him, then like he's cutting himself off from those three sons, the three of us. So they shouldn't have left Eretz Yisrael, in short. V'amar of Yitzchak, Oysa Yom Shabbos Rus HaMayavir LeEretz Yisrael, that same day that Rus came from Moab to Eretz Yisrael, Mesa Ishtei Shoboyaz, that same, the reason why, what's so serious about leaving Eretz Yisrael, Rashbam says over here, Shemafki Atzmim in HaMitzvahs, because the person is depriving himself of many mitzvahs that apply only in Eretz Yisrael. Other before the Ramban actually learns that it's actually one of the 613 mitzvahs to live in Eretz Yisrael. There's an enormous amount of discussion among Rishonim and Achronim about the ins and outs of that. And for example, would the Rambam disagree with that? The Rambam doesn't bring it as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Does that mean the Rambam disagrees that there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael? Or does he hold it's part of another mitzvah, or it's an overarching thing that includes many other mitzvahs? And why didn't the Rashbam mention that point? There's a lot of discussion among Mefarshim about various details in that. Okay, so the Gemara says, that same day that Rus HaMayavir came to Eretz Yisrael, Mesa Ishtei Shel Boaz, that same day Boaz's wife passed away. And in fact, Maharsha brings from the Medrash that what happened was, that's also why everybody was gathered, that's why everybody found out right away what happened with Nami, because they were all gathered there for the Levaya. And then all of a sudden, in walked Nomi and Rus. So Amr Bitoch Oisayim Shabbos Rusa Mayavila Eretz Yisrael. That same day that she came there, Mesa Ishta Shaboyas. Boyas' wife passed away. Vahainu Da Amri Inchi. This is like the expression people say. Adalai Shochiv Shachva. Before the person has passed away, Kaima Manu Bese. Right away, there's already standing over there the one who's going to take over and then and run his household. So Rus ended up marrying Boyas. So the same day that Boyas' wife passed away, the Eishta already has prepared his next wife for him, Rus. In fact, Marsha says that's part of the Vatehim Kol Ha'ir, that they all realize there's something unusual going on over here. Just now, Boaz's wife has passed away, and all of a sudden, this stranger comes to town. So it made them realize there's something unusual going on over here. Vatehim Kol Ha'ir Aleihem, they were all in an uproar, what's going on? And second of all, Vatehim Ma'ana Hazoyis Nami, a separate thing. Do you see what happened to Nami that she left Eretz Yisrael, and look what happened to her? So the Gemara continues, Omer Rab about Rabbi Yitzchak, or Huna, Omer Rab, Ivtson Ze Boyaz. Ivtson, who was mentioned, he's one of the Shroftim listed in Sefer Shroftim, he is identical with Boyaz of Megillas Rus. So the Gemara says, my Kamash Malon. Well, what does Rabbi Yitzchak, or Rab about Huna, want to tell us with that? What do we gain from that? Rashbam says, what do we learn, what mitzvah or anything do we learn from that? And the point is, Ma'arav Chayas explains in particular, the question is, in general, we have all over the place, all over where Chazal identify one person in Tanakh with another. I even once saw somebody gave a name for it, somebody gave a cute name for it, the law of conservation of biblical personalities, they call it. Like the law of if there's X number of people in Tanakh, you have to conserve that there shouldn't be more than necessary, and therefore you have to assume that this one is identical with that one. But it's a cute name for it. But anyway, when we do that, though, the point is because, for example, in one place the Torah tells us about some details about them under one name, and another place it tells us under another name, and therefore, by putting it all together, we have a more well-rounded picture of the person. But here, the pasuk tells us next to nothing about Ibsam the Shofet. It says he was from Beis Lechem. It says he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he married them all off, and that's about it. He judged the Jewish people for 7 years, and he passed away and is buried in Beis Lechem. That's the sum total of what it says about him. So why is it important for us to know that this almost anonymous Shofet is identical with Boaz, the hero of Megillas Rus? So the answer is Ki'idach to Rabbi Rav Yitzchak Huna. Because it goes together with another point that the same Rabbi Barab Yitzchak or Rabbi Barab Huna said, when we put those two things together, then we'll have the answer to our question. Da'amar Rabbi Barab Yitzchak or Huna, Amar Rab, Uf Chof Mishtois Osa Boyaz Levonav. Boyaz made 120 parties for his children. We said, as the Pasuk says, he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and we're saying that he's identical with Ivtson. So by Ivtson, the Pasuk Taka mentions that he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he married them all off. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, he had 30 bonim, ushloshim bonis shila hachutza. Then he had 30 daughters that he sent out, meaning he married them off to men from other places, and they went to live with their husbands. And he brought in 30 girls to marry his from outside, from other places, to marry his 30 sons. So in other words, he married off all 60 of his children. His sons stayed in Beis Lechem, where he lived, and his daughters went to live with their husbands wherever their husbands lived. Now, for each one of these children, he made two parties. Echad beveis aviv ve'echad beveis chomiv. One in the father's house, one in the father-in-law's house. So Rashbam explains that means that one was for the Sudas Erisin and one for the Sudas Nisuin. One when they first did the Kiddushin, and then in those times, as we know from all over Shas, they would usually do the Kiddushin and the Nisuin about a year apart. So they would make a party for the Kiddushin. I'll derech like nowadays, I guess the vague equivalent of it would be when we make a L'chaim. And then they had the actual Sudas Nisuin, the actual wedding, Suda. So there's 60 weddings, so therefore he made two Sudas for each one of them. Rashbam mentions there were other Lashonis in this Ve'en Behem Mamash. He says they're not really meaningful, but the Ravena Gershom gives one of those Lashonis, which is that the two parties are one when each child was born and another one when they got married. Anyway, now with all of them, he didn't invite Monoyach. Manoyach we have later on in the next pasuk that the Gemara had quoted over here about Ibsan is in Perek Yud Beis of Shoftim. The next Perek Yud Gimel starts by describing Manoyach and his wife how they were childless, and then a Malach came to Manoyach's wife, and afterwards they had Shimshin. So he didn't invite Manoyach, who lived at that time. Omar, because Boaz slash Ibsan says, couldn't you akora, this sterile mule, this childless mule, but my parali, with what could he pay me? In other words, he has no children that he would invite me to any of their sodas, so why should I invite him to mine? So it sounds like a terrible thing for a tzaddik like Boaz to say. How could he say such a thing? So Marsha says that what it means is like this. So later on in the Masechta, it talks about a concept called shushvinus. You know, a wedding is a very expensive thing to make, as anybody who's ever dealt with it knows. You have the two sides who contribute to it, hopefully, but it's still a big financial drain. So what they had in those times was a concept called shushvinus, basically like a mutual aid society. You would have a group of friends where all of the friends would, let's say, for example, Reuven, the first of the friends, is getting married. All of the friends would help contribute towards the wedding expenses, and Reuven would invite them to the wedding. With the idea being that now, when the next member of the group, when Shimon gets married, all of them are going to do the same thing. They're all going to help contribute to his wedding, and they'll all be invited, and so on and so forth. Later in the Masechta, you have many dinim, you have a whole sugya with dinim, with detailed dinim, all about this concept of shushvinus. Now, says Marsha, Boaz, it's even to the point where the Gemara mentions over there that it's even a debt that can actually be demanded and collected and based in. If later on one member of the group who previously contributed gets married and one or more of the other ones doesn't contribute his share, then he can actually take him to based in and force him to pay. So now if Boaz invites Manoach, then what is he going to have to do? He's going to have to either invite Boaz when one of his children gets married, but he doesn't have any children. So the alternative would be he'd have to give Boaz a present. But Boaz doesn't want. He doesn't want to accept presents. Therefore, he figured that how could he pay me back? So therefore, I don't want to invite him. So in other words, the idea being, it wouldn't be that he actually blatantly called him a sterile mule, but in other words, he's saying in a way, in other words, look, you know, the fact is, if I invite him, he has no way to pay me back, and therefore it's better not to do that. So another explanation in it is that it's not that he said that, it's that Manoach felt that way. Manoach was because he wasn't invited, then Manoach took it the wrong way and felt as though Boaz was thinking that way about him. And that's reason enough.
Truth, the guest would be helping paying.
So that in those times, that was the idea, like the guest would help pay towards it.
The problem is that Boaz would not be able to pay back
Manoach. No, the other way around. Manoach would, well, I mean, it would be, in other words, yeah, I mean, he wouldn't be able to contribute to Manoach's children's weddings because Manoach doesn't have any children, right? But it means also that means that Manoach himself wouldn't be able to, so that's the thing. Marshall says he would give Boaz a present as shushvinus, but then Manoach doesn't have any children, so then Boaz wouldn't be able to pay him back, right? Right.
So it's like
neither one of them would be able to pay back the other, kind of, yeah. So there's another explanation, not so much that he says that way, but that he doesn't invite Manoach and doesn't tell him why, and that makes it possible for Manoach to feel that way, as though he's not inviting me because I'm childless, and therefore he wants nothing to do with me, and the Gemara is going to go on to say next that Boaz suffered severely for that, actually. Ion Yaakov points out as well, another point the Gemara tells us in Brachas, that Manoach was an Amoretz. So it was actually there may have been an actual valid reason for Boaz not to invite him on those grounds. Nevertheless, though, you still don't think of a fellow Yid that way. You still shouldn't have thought of him. You shouldn't have belittled him so much just because he's Namor. It's fine to find some other way to honor him, basically. Tana, we learn in a Braisa, v'chulam mesu b'chayev. All of those 60 children all passed away in Boaz's lifetime. So now, Rechbam takes out the word Tana because it's the end of what Rabba Bar Rav Yitzchok or Rabba Bar Rav Huna is explaining. Meaning, in other words, now that we put this all together, we understand what happened over here. By knowing that Ibsan Zeb Boaz, if we didn't know that they were the same person, we wouldn't know that Boaz had previously had children. Now, though, we learn that we see that the Boaz went to the trouble of marrying Ruth, even though he had many children. So we learn from that, Rashbam says, we learn the concept, which the Gemara mentions in the Yevamos, that even if a person has many children from his first wife, he still should go and marry a second wife, because you never know, the children, his children, or even, for example, he was married in his young age and had children, he should still make sure, he should still try to have children in his old age as well, because you never know what's going to come of the earlier children versus the later one. As we see, says Rav Barav Yitzchak or Rav Barav Huna, as you see, the first 60 children all passed away, and the only one that's left is his one son from Ruth, Ovid, who became the ancestor of David, and everything developed from there. So it comes out, by the way Rashbam is saying it, it comes out that these 60 children did outlive Boaz. What it means is rather that Boaz outlived them, but then after that he married Ruth and had Ovid with her. Now there is a medrash that says actually on the night he married Ruth, they had relations. She conceived. She later on had Ovid, but meanwhile Boaz passed away. The way Rashbam phrases it over here is mashma that even though the children, the 60 children, are still alive when Boaz is at this point, he still married Ruth anyway so that he can have more children. But if we say that Boaz passed away on that night, then Marsha points out it really wouldn't necessarily work. Marshall doesn't say this, other Mepharshim say it really wouldn't work, because then what do you mean? He's not deliberately, unless you say, in other words, if you say the 60 children passed away in his lifetime, then fine. It means that, but Rashbam is making the point that even though he has many children, he still went to the trouble of marrying Rus. That doesn't seem to work well with the Medrash that he passed away on the night he married Rus. So Behainu de Amri Inchi, this is like the expression people say, Behayach de Yaldus Shisin. Even if in your lifetime you had 60 children, as Boaz did, shisin lomalich dialadta, what good do the 60 do that you fathered? Ichbal, continue, marry another wife if necessary, v'olad chad, and father one, demin shikin zoriz, who will be quicker and stronger than the one. So in other words, then the 60. So the nimshal is over here, in other words, that Boaz had these 60 children, but we're saying kulam mesu b'chayav, they all passed away in Boaz's lifetime. And then who's the one who's his posterity that everything continues from there is the one son Ovid that he had with Ruth, who's the grandfather of David. So you learn from this, as Rashbam says, the importance of that a person shouldn't think, well, I had children when I was younger, that's good enough. Here he had 60 children and he still went and had more as well.
So they passed before or after he was married?
So that's the thing. Rashbam says that they all passed away in his lifetime, b'chayav. Well, the Gemara says b'chayav. So Rashbam says that he knowingly, even though knowing that at this point he still has children, he didn't know they were all going to die in his lifetime. Nevertheless, he still married Ruth to have more children with her. However, now, so Marasha points out like this. The phrasing that the Gemara uses is b'chayav di'alad d'shisin. In your lifetime, you fathered 60, but nevertheless, ichbal v'olad chad, still go ahead and have even one more. Now, there it doesn't say the word b'chayacha. Marasha points out this can be a remez to the fact that it says in the Medrash that Boaz passed away that night after he and Ruth first had relations and then conceived Ovid, and then he passed away. So yeah, other Mephoshim point out then it doesn't really fit to say, so if you say that they passed away before Ruth ever came on the scene, fine, then it's understandable that he went to the trouble. But if Rashbam is making the point that he knew he still had the 60 children and yet he knowingly married Ruth to have another child with her, then it wouldn't really work with that Medrash that he passed away on that night.
And why is the son is not being named after him if he passed away the same day?
Not always did they name after fathers or after ancestors in those days. In those days, the Medrash said they had Ruach HaKodesh more so than parents have nowadays, and therefore they would sometimes use new names rather than naming after the father. Rashbam mentions another point, which he says that maybe he says that some explain, which you can find this in Rabbeinu Gershom, that the Chad Min Shittin Zoriz is actually referring to Shimshon. That it means, in other words, here, you had Boaz of 60, who all passed away, versus Manoach eventually had the one mighty son, Shimshon. But Rashbam says it doesn't really work. Let me hear the klal. It's not really clear, because the implication of the Gemara is the same person had the 60 and then had the one, which fits better with Boaz / Ibsan, rather than saying that one of them is referring to Manoach. The Gemara continues. Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava Amar Rav, Elimelech, the Elimelech of Nomi's husband from the beginning of Rus, the Salmon, and Salmon, who we have at the end of Megillas Rus, we have the family tree going down from Peretz down to Obed and down to David. So you have over there mentioned Salmon was the father of Boaz. So Uploni Amoni, then you have in Perek Dalad of Megillas Rus, you have where Boaz calls over the Goyo Uploni Amoni, you're a closer relative, you have first rights to decide to buy back Nomi in Rus's field and also to marry Rus. The guy says, I don't want to, and so Boaz takes over the responsibility and he marries Rus and everything develops from there. Famously the Medrash says on it, Rashi brings it on the Psukim over there. After Goyal says, he says, Pen Ashkus as Nachlosi, I'm going to destroy my heritage. So Rashi brings over there from the Medrash that he said, look, she's from Moav, you're not allowed to intermarry with Moavin. He didn't know the halacha. He didn't know the halacha that Amoni v'lo Amonis Moavi v'lo Moavis. Anyway, so the pasuk calls him Ploni Almoni, which literally means the anonymous one. The Medrash says that, and also a meaning of it is Almoni Meloshen Elaim. He's mute. He doesn't know how to speak words of Torah. He didn't know that halacha about Moavi v'lo Moavis. Anyway, so he. Ba'avi Naomi, and the father of Naomi, Kulam b'nei Nachshon min Aminadav. All of them are sons of Nachshon min Aminadav. So in other words, they're all four brothers, right. So it means that Elimelech and Naomi were uncle and niece, which you're really allowed to, la'halacha, an uncle can marry a niece. In fact, the Gemara in a couple of places recommends it. But it also means, therefore, it means that when you're in the psukim over there, in Perek Gimel of Rus, when Rus comes to spend the night in the granary, and in the middle of the night, Boaz wakes up, and she tells him, you know, it's your responsibility to marry me and to be the goyel of my family, and he says, I would like to, but gam yesh goyel kor of mi meni, you should know there's a closer goyel than me, so tomorrow morning we'll take care of the matter. Why is that? Now we understand, based on this Gemara, because, in other words, my father would have been the closer goyel because my father. We're talking about property that was sold by Elimelech and his family. So if it was my father Salmon, fine. Salmon is Elimelech's brother, so he would be a very close goyel. But I'm only a second level goyel. The Ploni Almoni, which the Medrash identifies his actual name was Toiv. He's a brother of Elimelech. I'm only a nephew of Elimelech. So therefore, he has first rights. And if he doesn't want to, then I take it up next. The Medrash has a different opinion that says it slightly differently, that says that Boaz is in fact one of the brothers, but the vote would be, in other words, then the Ploni Almoni is an elder brother. So he has first rights, just like we find by Yibam. Anyway, so the Gemara says, my Kamash Malan, again, why is it important for us to know that detail? So it teaches us, even somebody who has schus of his ancestors, all of them were saying are sons of Nachshon and Aminadav, the great Nachshon, the Nossi, the Mesiras Nefesh Yid. Nevertheless, Enoi Medesvoy, it still doesn't stand by him. The Sharshi Yotzim and Aretz the Chutz La'aretz, if he leaves Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz, as Elimelech did, and therefore, as we said before, he didn't have that schus to protect him.
One of them lived for many, many years, hundreds of years.
It means that one of them lived for hundreds of years, yeah. In fact, by the way, like this we said before, Ivsan Zaboyaz, there's actually the Seder Olam actually learns differently and says that the story of Rus and Boaz happened near the beginning. So it comes, according to that, Ivsan was one of the later Shoftim. You have, after Ivsan, you have only a couple of more Shoftim, and then it's the end of that period. The Seder Olam actually has it differently. It has that the story of Boaz and Rus happened near the beginning of the time of the Shoftim, in the time of Othniel or Ehud, one of the first two Shoftim. So according to that, yeah, it would mean that they're not long after the time of Nachshon, but yeah, it means, in other words, to get from there to David, you still need a considerable amount of time. There is, in fact, a Medrash someplace that says that Yishai lived 300 or 400 years, so that would work with that. There is a Pirush from Sadia Goyen on Megillas Rus. I just came across a reference to this the other day, where he says that actually, when it says at the end of the Megillah over there, when it says, Oyvid heard us Yishai, the Yishai heard us David, he learns that the Yishai there is not actually the father of David, but rather an ancestor. So in other words, according to him, there may be more generations in between there that are not listed in the Psukim. Okay. Anyway, so even they have schus avos, and in fact, Marsha points out, you think about it, it means, in other words, that Machlon and Kilian, therefore, are doubly descended from Nachshon, because their father, Elimelech, then is a son of Nachshon, so they're grandsons of Nachshon from one side. From the other side, we said Naomi's father is also a son of Nachshon, so meaning, in other words, they're great-grandchildren of Nachshon on that side, and nevertheless, because they left Eretz Yisrael, they lost their schus and they ended up dying in Moab there. So he gave his life away for Mesiras Nefesh to go into the Yamsuf to get to Eretz Yisrael, and they lost that. Yeah, even Yaakov points out the flip side of it is Rus had absolutely no schus of this, but she came to Eretz Yisrael and she had the schus to marry Boaz and to be the ancestress of David. By the way, she herself lived long also. By Shlomo HaMelech it says near the beginning of Sefer Melachim. At one point, Bathsheba came to visit Shlomo and had a request from him. So the pasuk says over there, "Vayosim kise." The pasuk says they set up a throne for her, and then it says, "Vayosim kise la'ema melech." They set up a throne for the mother of the king, and she sat down. Rashi brings over there from the Medrash, this mother of the king is Rus. She's still alive then to be able to see her descendants actually sitting on the throne and then being kings.
Probably the course of the Moab is no longer in that Moab. They
want to show that she's, could be,
descendant.
Okay. Fine.
So, I just heard that Yishai, he originally married.
Yes, there's a well-known story that's brought in various Sfarim that Yishai originally was married to a regular Jewish woman. We're going to learn her name tomorrow, actually, in the Gemara. And then he got concerned that if he's descended from Rus, then maybe he's not a legitimate Yid, and maybe he should marry a Shifcha. Yeah, you have a whole story over there where he planned to have relations with a Shifcha, and meanwhile his wife found out about it, and she went in there instead, and that's how David was conceived, and that's why the brothers thought he was a no good nick and a mamzer and all that. Yeah, it's a well-known story. Yeah.
When Shmuel came to anoint David, I guess that
came. That's why they didn't even bring David in, right? That's why they just said David after Shmuel goes through seven of the boys and none of them is the one. Samuel and Orim, all the boys, have ever gone through all the boys and there anybody else? And then Yishai has to say, yeah, there's my little son David out in the field with the sheep. Yeah, they didn't even think to bring him because
son, I think it is.
I think yeah, there was that explanation too. Yeah. Yeah.
But that kind of made the whole thing.
So this is also when we say here we're going to a few days we're going to be saying hallow. You know, when you have Evan Masar Burnham, Marisa Burishkina, one of the meanings of it is referring to David himself. That was the stone that all the builders scorned. This is going to be a stone of the Jewish people, Marisa Burishkina, and becomes the centerpiece over there. The Gemara, in fact, in Pesachim tells us that all those Pesachim, beginning from Oidcha until the end of Hallel, are all said by the various different ones are said by the different people who were there at the time. David says, Oidcha ki ani sani, the brothers say, Evan Moasu Abonim, Yishai says, Me'es Hashem, who says, one of them, I don't remember all the, who says what, but whatever. Yishai says something, Shmuel says something, all of them say something. This is all at that occasion when Shmuel came to anoint a new king, and they all finally realized how we misjudged David all these years. So yeah, those psukim are all expressing what they felt at that time. Okay, Yomiyah Mashiach Ge'ula, Chavavad Aleph, one time when the Rebbe was giving out dollars, one of the Maskirim brought to the Rebbe a newspaper reporter, and he asked, and this guy asked, what's the Rebbe, what's your message for the whole world? And the Rebbe says, I want you to publicize in your newspaper that Mashiach is about to come, and in fact, he's already on the way. Chavavah the Beis, then, you have in Shiras Dvora and in Sefer Shoftim, so you have a lot over there about the primary concepts of Avoida of Neshei Yisrael and whose chus the Geula will come. We have, she's called Eishes Lapidos because, as Rashi mentions over there, she made wicks for the Beis Mikdash. So then in the Mikdash in every year, the women are the ones who light Shabbos and Yom Tov candles and illuminate the whole house, and thereby they illuminate the whole area and the whole world, just like Dvora made wicks for the Beis Mikdash and enlighten the whole world with that. And when the pasuk says that she was sitting under the palm tree of Dvora, and Rashi brings over there from the Gemara that why daft under a palm tree, because it's tall and doesn't cast much shade, and this way there wouldn't be an issue of Yichud. So this is the Milo of Sneus of Kol Kavod Las Melech Pnimah. Okay. We were talking about more dinner with tzitzis. Suppose that a person puts two tzitzis on one corner of a talus. So then it's bal toisif. He's over on bal toisif, and therefore he makes it possible. So now, if he cuts off one of them, it doesn't matter which one he cuts off, it'll still be kosher. Ah, you can argue, says the Alter Rebbe, the second one was put on when it was possible, because the second one, he was over on bal toisif. Shouldn't it be then that if he cuts off the first one and leaves the second one, won't it be tasav alemin asui? No, it's not, because the fact that he put a second one, precisely because it's bal toisif, therefore, in a certain sense, we don't count it as an asiya. So therefore, it's counted as if he didn't do anything yet. So there's no asiya yet. Now, when he cuts off the original one, so now it's considered more of a maisa. This is how the Gemara explains it. And therefore, so now it's considered. Now it's not tasav alemin asui. Now he's doing a maisa to make tzitzis, and therefore it's fine. So it's fine either way. But as long as there are two of them there, it would be also because of bal toisif.
So,